I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Tony Wright has been released from prison after serving more than two decades behind bars for crimes he did not commit. Wright and some of the jurors from his second trial talked today in Philadelphia about the case and his new freedom, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Wearing a blue button-down shirt and a black blazer, Tony Wright paused before speaking to contemplate a quarter century of confinement. He wiped tears from his eyes.
Oh, man, 25 years, man.
Wright's attorneys convinced the judge to order DNA tests of the Chicago Bulls sweatshirt and jeans police said he wore when a 77-year-old neighbor was raped and murdered in 1991. Then Wright was granted a new trial, and the jury acquitted him. Wright says police framed him and coerced him into signing a confession. When police arrested him at 20 years old, he had a toddler.
I want somebody to look my son in his face and explain to them why his dad was gone for 25 years. For what?
The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office decided to retry him, saying Wright may have been an accomplice to the murder. Shayna Batis didn't believe prosecutors. She was juror number one.
I literally cried tears of sadness at times during the trial and tears of joy after the foreperson announced our verdict.
That forewoman was Grace Greco.
I almost felt that I knew Tony personally as I was listening to the evidence for the last 2 weeks. You know, I just felt like it was, I can't even put it into words. It just was overwhelming.
The Innocence Project helped win a new trial for Wright. The group says he is the 344th inmate in the country to be freed after DNA tests. Here's Wright again.
When the DNA results came back and said that I wasn't the guy, I didn't care what happened after that. The world knew that I was innocent of this crime for which I was accused and charged and convicted of.
Wright fought in appeals courts for years before landing a new trial. He recalls hearing that inmates in other states were being released after DNA tests.
People being exonerated with the same type of cases, and I couldn't figure out why it wasn't happening for me.
One of the first things he did Tuesday night when he walked out of the prison cell, asked his legal team for a sweet treat.
They got me the best piece of cheesecake. I think it was a vanilla cream. It was unbelievable, man. I was eating so much they had to take it away from me.
Wright's attorney wouldn't comment on whether he'll file a civil suit for compensation after his unjustified time in prison. While that's being thought over, Wright says he has another priority: to go to Florida and visit his 90-year-old grandmother and give her a big hug. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Italians in Philadelphia have been racing to their computers and phones to try to get information about loved ones in central Italy. That's where a massive earthquake destroyed entire towns early this morning. More than 120 people have been killed by the tremor, and that death toll may still climb as officials search through the rubble. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
The America-Italy Society of Philadelphia, which normally teaches language classes, has been fielding dozens of phone calls from people trying to figure out if their friends and family in Italy are okay. Director Franca Riccardi has been combing through maps to help people pinpoint the exact locations of villages like Amatrice, Norcia, Accumoli, and Pescara del Tronto.
They are very small villages, so sometimes these villages have names that are very similar, so they don't really understand very well the spelling, the Italian spelling, so they are really worried.
Some of those villages are 1,000 years old or more, perched on picturesque mountainsides. It's fantastically beautiful if you're a tourist, but Michael Bonacera of the Italian Immigration Museum in South Philadelphia says it makes it nearly impossible to navigate a search and rescue operation.
So many of these towns are small, older towns with very narrow streets. Lucky that you can get a car through it, you know, without bringing in the side view mirrors. If there is a disaster on that road, it's impassable. There is no passing through that.
That region was last hit by a major earthquake 7 years ago in 2009 when the village of L'Aquila was leveled. The owners of a restaurant destroyed in that quake relocated the restaurant to Philadelphia, naming it Grand Café L'Aquila. One of those owners is Stefano Biasini, who happened to be visiting the old village when this latest earthquake hit. His partner, Ricardo Longo, has been in touch with him and says he's okay.
Because of what happened in the previous earthquake, everyone's reaction was to run out into the streets. So he said that most people basically slept outside because they were terrified. He told me he slept in his car, parked away from any kind of building.
Longo says as soon as all his partners are back in Philadelphia, they will hold a fundraiser to help earthquake victims. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
1988 was the last time a Republican was elected governor in Delaware. That's when Mike Castle won his second term. On September 13th, Republicans will choose who they hope will be the next GOP governor of the first state. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more in the first of two reports on those candidates.
We met Lacey Lafferty at her horse farm in Laurel to talk about why she's making her first run for office as a Republican gubernatorial candidate.
I'm running for governor because I love Delaware. I think we all know that the state of Delaware is on a decline.
Lafferty is a former state police trooper. She served 13 years before being forced to retire after suffering some hearing loss related to her police radio. In 2007, she was awarded the State Police Excellent Performance Award by then-Governor Ruth Ann Minner. She's counting on her experience as an investigator to be able to solve the state's problems.
It's a lot of fraud, waste, and corruption going on in our government that it continues to proliferate. As an investigator in law enforcement and award-winning state trooper, this is where my expertise comes in here to be able to root out state government of the fraud, waste, and corruption.
Lafferty is a political newcomer, so she got her campaign started early. 4 years ago early. To raise awareness of her campaign and to boost her name awareness, she's walked the entire length of the state.
I started out here going to meetings, festivals, parades, walking the entire state from Delaware, Maryland line to Claymont up there and over a course of 3.5 days, just for people to come out here, I'm accessible to you. I walked the width of the state last year, same way, to get people to, I'm accessible to you. Come out and talk to me.
Lafferty's background is in contrast to her Republican opponent, State Senator Colin Bonini, who's been in the legislature since 1994.
I bring a contrast to Senator Colin Bonini, who's been in there as a career politician, you know, doing the same old, yay and nay to different policies, really not helping anybody's problems out here.
Lafferty hopes the Donald Trump-fueled anti-establishment sentiment will work in her favor, both against Bonini in the primary and then against Democrat John Carney in November.
Whether it be Colin Bonini or John Carney, both of them have been in politics for 22 to 25 years. They don't bring fresh ideas or what's going on down here with everybody else out here trying to make a living.
Lafferty supports Donald Trump as the Republican presidential nominee, but admits he's got his flaws.
I would say his worst character is that he's got a big mouth. I don't think he's got a mean bone in his body, or he would actually, you know, do some of the things that, but it's, you have to understand his persona, his, you know, where they're from. They're very gruff kind of mannerism. You know, New Yorkers tend to be a bit gruff. Donald, to me, is a great, great person.
And like Trump's depiction of the State of the Union, Lafferty paints a dire picture of the state of Delaware.
We're in a sad state of affairs, economically, as well as job creation, Department of Education. I mean, right now we have a climate of, you know, subgrade intellectual, you know, people that we're putting out here in our communities. I want to be able to take that knowledge that I have, lifelong skills, to improve our state of affairs, you know, government affairs, as well as economics, restoring jobs, improving our education.
Republican voters get to weigh in on September 13th and pick the candidate to run against Democrat John Carney. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Mark Eichmann will profile the other GOP candidate, Colin Bonini, on tomorrow's program. Still ahead, we look at the technology that went into the Pennsylvania canal system.
How man was changing the landscape, people really didn't think about that when they were making all of these changes.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. It's not a tuition hike, but there is a new charge this semester affecting Swarthmore College students, as well as faculty and staff. Let's learn more with Aurora Winslade, the college's Director of Sustainability, and Swarthmore Vice President for Finance and Administration, Greg Brown. Aurora, Greg, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Greg, first one to you. We want to make sure that it's not any kind of new fee for students, faculty, and staff. We're talking about a carbon charge. How does it work?
Well, the carbon charge is a budget mechanism, but what it's really doing is raising awareness and raising funds. So we are charging each department on campus an assessment essentially against their carbon use, and then taking that and using it for carbon and sustainability projects, as well as educational projects on campus that will help the students with making the campus more hands-on as a greening campus.
Aurora, tell us more about the campus being more hands-on. I understand Swarthmore is one of the first to take this route, although it's relatively or increasingly popular in the business sector.
We are. We're among a small group of institutions who are setting an internal price on carbon. And we're doing that both because there's a lot of work to be done on our campus in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And this, as Greg said, provides us with a fund to finance those projects. But it's also an educational opportunity, because if we can put a price on carbon nationally, internationally, it represents one of the main paths forward for rapidly reducing greenhouse gas emissions that we know we need to reduce.
And so, Greg, how is that internal price set?
Well, the price is set based on the size of the budget for now, but as we implement it, we're going to start looking at carbon usage. So, for example, our admissions office travels a great deal. Their carbon footprint is a lot different from Aurora's or mine, who are on campus most of the time. So we're starting to think about what people's impact is. So a science lab also is more expensive to run than a dormitory room. So starting to come up with pricing that comes off of that makes a lot of sense, and it raises awareness in a really positive way.
Initially, though, this rate is set, I believe, at 1.25% for each department?
That's right.
How was that number picked?
What we did was we looked at trying to recover about $300,000 to $400,000. So that number came out of the need to pull in that dollar figure as a starting point.
And then what happens with the accrued funds?
The accrued funds are going into a central committee-run process where we'll be entertaining proposals for things that are both studying ways to change carbon, but more importantly, actually having an impact. Because one of the things we hear from our students is they want to see action. And as much as we're building green buildings, it's hard for them to see those workings. So what we really want to do is have a very open process about how the money gets spent.
How far do you go in calculating a department's carbon charge?
We do a greenhouse gas inventory, and there's a sort of standard accounting practices that we follow. When you're doing a greenhouse gas inventory and you're really getting granular about your carbon emissions, you look at scope 1 emissions are emissions that are generated on site. Scope 2 emissions are things like purchased electricity. And scope 3 emissions then are going to be the things like air travel and embodied carbon in products. And so anything that has carbon emissions in it falls into one of these three scopes. And so we look at scope 1, scope 2, and we try to capture scope 3 emissions. So things like purchases and goods do fall under scope 3. They're very hard to get at. And really, there's some tools. Carnegie Mellon has a tool for trying to really calculate the embodied carbon in a given product. It's much easier when you're looking at fuel, electricity, things that we have very detailed numbers on, and we know what our fuel mix is, we know where our electricity comes from, and we can actually get quite granular in terms of our emissions. So That's we do an annual carbon inventory.
And I think by sharing more of the data that goes with that, and I think that's something that most of us don't do a good job of, pushing that data back to the department to say, well, you know, actually, compared to other dormitories, your usage is high, so you should set a goal, and we work with you to set a goal. So I think that the carrot and stick piece of this really does play into getting the information out there so that people have a metric to measure from. And I don't think we've done a good job of that in the past. So I think this carbon charge is going to help us enormously with that.
And so, Aurora, Greg, thank you for bringing this rich conversation on an important topic to our listening audience. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Aurora Winslade, Swarthmore College's Director of Sustainability, and Greg Brown, Swarthmore Vice President for Finance and Administration. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Say the term revolutionary technology, and perhaps smartphones come to mind, or Facebook. But long before Mark Zuckerberg, canals were the big disruptors. They redrew the wilderness and remade the country's economy. In Pennsylvania, the linchpin of the canal system can be seen at a National Park Service site in Blair County. Tomorrow, the Park Service will celebrate 100 years. So Margaret J. Krause visited the Allegheny Portage Railroad and offers this unlikely story of how canals helped to create a gateway to the West.
Park Ranger Doug Bosley says he still kind of can't believe that Pennsylvania pulled it off.
Nothing about this was easy.
Bosley is showing me a stretch of track that runs uphill at a pretty steep slope for a railroad, a 6 or 7% grade. It was one of a series of tracks called the Allegheny Portage Railroad that stepped its way over Allegheny Mountain. It wasn't a huge hill, but at the time, it took some doing.
The locomotives weren't very powerful. A lot of them were only 20 to 30 horsepower. Your lawn tractor at home, more powerful than the locomotives at that time.
We're standing at the crest of what's now a quiet green hillside. But the Allegheny Portage Railroad National Historic Site was once part of a short-lived, revolutionary system that transformed Pennsylvania forever. Here's how it happened. The 1820s was a time of national expansion, fueled by American chutzpah.
Sort of the age of Jackson, the President Andrew Jackson, and sort of the everyman age. Everybody can rise up, no matter what station you started out in life. That was the can-do attitude.
As the U.S. border edged westward, there were greater opportunities to move raw materials such as timber from the west to the east and finished products back in the other direction.
But there was no practical way to do it.
That is, until the Erie Canal opened in New York in 1825. While it took 3 to 4 weeks to ship goods on pack animals west across Pennsylvania, it took just 10 days to send them on the Erie Canal. New York boomed, and Pennsylvania didn't want to lose out.
Technology maybe wasn't quite ready yet, but they made it work because nobody wanted to be left behind.
Enter the Pennsylvania Main Line of Public Works. That was the very formal name for a system of canals funded by the state to connect Philadelphia to Pittsburgh and on to points west. It was nearly 400 miles of inland waterways, with the exception of this 36-mile Allegheny Portage Railroad.
The surveyors came through, staked out the line where the railroad would be, and then the first work that was done was cutting a 120-foot-wide swath through the forest.
When the main line opened for business in 1834, it was like the Amazon.com of the 19th century. Suddenly, everyday people could afford to buy the things they needed and get them in a timely fashion. But these modern conveniences came at a cost. The most notorious instance of this was making the canal reservoir outside Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Turns out, one of the biggest problems of running a canal system is keeping enough water in there so boats can run even in dry seasons. So the mainline system dammed South Fork Creek to create the reservoir. It failed. Big. When it broke in 1889, the flood killed 2,209 people.
The respect for the power of nature and how man was changing the landscape, people really didn't think about that when they were making all of these changes.
Louis Quett is a hydraulic engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I spoke with him at his office in downtown Pittsburgh. He spends his days controlling water flow in local rivers, and he says the canal system of the 1830s continues to inform river traffic today.
It is folly for us to believe that we can control nature. But it is certainly reasonable for humans to work with nature.
Today, few sections of the main line survive, and none are used commercially. About 20 years after it was completed, the Pennsylvania Railroad purchased the whole system. While the canals may be gone, water is still how we move a lot of goods from point A to point B. Things like coal, farm produce, and petroleum products ply the inland waterways through the Army Corps' river system of locks and dams, which kicked off in the late 1800s.
We don't see an end to river navigation. Our roads are certainly already crowded, and a single standard barge holds as much cargo as 15 railroad cars or 60 semi-trucks.
So Quett says leveraging the power of water might be an old idea, but it's one that still works in the 21st century. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
The Allegheny Front reports on environmental topics in Pennsylvania. Finally this evening, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney today signed into law a bill making all parks inclusive. Councilwoman Cindy Bass says the legislation will provide park access to every city resident.
Today we are sending a message that we are going beyond just accessibility and into active participation for all.
The bill mandates that parks be equipped for those with special needs and even the elderly, which Mayor Jim Kenney says will help make for a more physically fit city. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. As we heard earlier, Delaware holds its GOP gubernatorial primary September 13th, and tomorrow evening, we'll meet Colin Bonini, the second of two candidates vying to become the first state's first Republican governor in nearly three decades. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.